Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today is baseball's opening day, and on the first day of the new season, we remember a baseball great who transcended sport and became a potent symbol during a dark chapter in American and world history. The 1930s was a decade of virulent anti-Semitism, both at home and abroad. Of course, we remember Nazi actions and rhetoric, but we forget that American anti-Semitic rhetoric during those days was equally virulent. You had the Klan, the German-American Bund, Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent, and Father Charles Coughlin, the latter two headquartered in and around Detroit, who all denigrated Jewish character and accomplishment. So it is a little ironic that the first Jewish-American sports superstar would play for the Detroit Tigers. Hank Greenberg became a national hero for America's Jewish community. In a career that lasted 9 seasons and was interrupted by nearly 4 years in the military in World War II, in fact, he was one of the first athletes inducted, Greenberg won 2 World Series victories, led his team to 2 other World Series, won the American League Most Valuable Player twice. He hit over 330 home runs, a .313 lifetime batting average, and hit over 1,200 RBIs. He later would join the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 1956. But more importantly, he shattered a lot of misheld American stereotypes. My guest today is the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. John Rosengren is a baseball writer, journalist, and author of several other books. He joins us today to talk about the accomplishments on and off the field of Hank Greenberg. John Rosengren, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Tell us a little bit, this is a fascinating book about Hank Greenberg because it gets into politics, it gets into all sorts of issues of ethnicity, as well as an incredible baseball player. What interests you in Hank Greenberg?
As I was doing the research for this book, I discovered that Greenberg was a great player, was a Hall of Fame player, but in order to appreciate his significance as a cultural icon, one had to understand him within the context of his time. And during the 30s and 40s when he was playing, there was a much stronger ethnic identification. You know, people had grown up, many second-generation immigrants had grown up speaking their mother tongue at home, so Polish or German or Italian. In Hank's case, Yiddish with his parents from Romania. So there was very strong ethnic identification. There was also intense anti-Semitism, not just what was happening in Europe, but here in the United States. Anti-Semitism was as socially acceptable and widely practiced as Jim Crow laws in the South. And then Greenberg was a baseball player, and baseball was then the national pastime. This was before the NBA. The NFL was in its infancy. No one cared about the NHL. So baseball was the sport that put players on the national stage. And here comes Greenberg, the 6'4", 220-pound guy slugging home runs who shatters all the stereotypes that Americans might have had of Jews. And he became a beacon of hope for Jews to rally around and feel good about during a time of intense turmoil. And all that wrapped together attracted me to his story and made me think, this is a guy who transcended baseball. Though, being a baseball fan, there's also plenty of baseball for me to write about. And I just thought it was a story worth telling.
And what's interesting is throughout his career, even after he's a star, he's still dealing with anti-Semitic slurs on a regular basis. Now, I guess to put it in perspective, in those days, any person of ethnicity would have to deal with that. But what was also interesting was he had a fan club in every city he went to from Jewish fans that idolized Hank Greenberg.
That's true. For Greenberg, being Jewish was a blessing and a curse. As you mentioned, the Jews identified with him and saw him as one of their own and looked up to him. And so every city he played in, particularly New York, he had fans there. There was a guy in New York who would bring him bagels with locks on them give them to him during the games. So he had a large following and large fan base. At the same time, he was a lightning rod for the bigots. And during that time of intense ethnic identification, that also became a weapon to use against players, and not just the Jews, but the Italians or the Irish, you know, be called a whopper mick. But there were 4 or 5 of those guys usually on the field to absorb that, whereas Hank was often the lone Jew on the field and stood alone as a target. So had to weather all that abuse himself, and he got it, not just from opponents or from fans in other cities, but even in Detroit, which was a hotbed of anti-Semitism, and from his own teammates, many of whom had never met a Jew before they met Greenberg. So there were times when he stood up to that with his fists, including fighting his own teammates, but more often he reacted or responded with his bat and came through in clutch situations to show the others what he could do.
You know, you mentioned early in his career when he's in the minor leagues, he's in the South, and he has teammates coming up and just sort of staring at him, walking. There's one particular teammate that was walking around him and staring, and he said, "What are you staring at?" And he says, "Oh, I've never seen a Jew before. I just want to see what." I mean, to me, that level of ignorance is just amazing, and I don't know if that was basically a slur or he was accidentally ignorant, but he ran into that throughout the minor leagues where, you know, Jewish people were sort of a novelty for a lot of these rural Southern players, and it was probably the first Jew they'd ever met.
Yes, I think that anecdote is telling. That was JoJo White, a guy from rural Georgia, who was called JoJo because of the way he pronounced Georgia. And he walked around Greenberg one day in the field, and Greenberg said he felt like a freak in a carnival show and said, "What are you looking at?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd never seen a Jew before, and you don't look any different." And Greenberg said, "Well, what were you expecting, you know, horns?" But we forget today, I think, with the tremendous amount of media we have and access to the Internet, you know, how much we can explore things. Back in the 30s, and this was not the case. And so someone growing up in a rural area hadn't been exposed to a lot of other people, hadn't seen a lot of other things, and they were encountering a Jew for the first time, and so all they had to go on was the stereotypes that they'd been fed. On the flip side, Greenberg grew up in the Bronx, and while we may not think of it as this way today, he was very sheltered because he grew up in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood, so he never really had to think about what it meant to be a Jew because everyone around him was Jewish, the same as he was. But then when he left, that's when he had to confront his identity and discovered what it meant to be a Jew.
Now, growing up, I mean, when you think of Hank Greenberg today, you think of this giant player who could really swat home runs, runs batted in, at least as far as his baseball record. And he sort of had a larger-than-life persona, and I think a lot of times that was because of the era, the 1930s. You have Hitler, you have all the anti-Semitism that's rearing its head in the United States in response to all this anti-Semitism abroad, as well as homegrown. And so for many people, he was a larger-than-life image. But what was interesting about him, as far as being a natural athlete, you write that he perhaps was not the most natural athlete. He was large, but he was not particularly graceful, fast. He was more lumbering than anything else, is from your descriptions of the book. He really had to work incredibly hard. I mean, how he got to the big leagues was he worked harder than most.
Yes, Greenberg is a Horatio Alger story. He was blessed with size and strength. And by the time he was 13, he was 6'3". And his coordination didn't really catch up to him, so he wasn't blessed with natural agility. And as a result, he was subject to all sorts of ridicule. His high school coach put him on first base because that's where he could do the least bit of damage to the team. But others, sports writers, poked a lot of fun at him, saying things like watching Greenberg field ground balls was like watching an elephant pick up marbles with his toes. And he knew that was a liability, and as a result, he worked very hard to improve his hitting and his fielding, and he spent hours as a kid practicing in Crotona Park across the street from his boyhood home, and that continued that ethic. As he got to the big leagues, he would arrive at the park an hour, 2 hours early to take extra batting practice. And it paid off for him. He also did things like took boxing lessons to improve his hand-eye coordination or took dance lessons to improve his agility. So he worked very hard, and that work ethic paid off in a Hall of Fame induction at the end of his career.
Now, he chose to sign with Detroit. He goes through the minor leagues. I think he really expected to be in the major leagues a lot quicker than he did, and he was somewhat petulant as a youth, really kind of expecting things to be handed to him. When he gets to Detroit the first time, he's surprised to be shunned. And in those days, a rookie was like, well, he was after one of our jobs. And like any workplace, he was shunned. And it's interesting, during the course of his career, he really worked to change that sort of mentality of welcoming young ballplayers to the team.
Yes, when Greenberg arrived with the Tigers in 1930, he was 19 years old. And I think he expected the team to be more welcoming. But as you pointed out, the veterans were not, because they saw him out to take their jobs, and it was a much more cutthroat environment. With only 16 major league teams, the competition was fierce. And whenever a newcomer came up, especially someone like Greenberg, who'd been given a bunch of money to sign with the Tigers, that he got $9,000, which then was a lot more money than those players, more than most were making during a season. So they just shunned him, ignored him. He called it the psychological warfare of the time. But knowing what he, how he'd suffered through that, and you know, been so bad it made him want to quit at times, he in turn reached out to young guys when they came up, and he taught them how to. Some of them, you know, didn't know how to use a knife and fork in a restaurant. He taught them how to dress. He bought them clothes. He just taught them the ropes of living a big league life. And that was typical of Greenberg, where he would take something that he'd suffered and turn around and want to and be sympathetic to others. As a result of the abuse he got as a Jewish ball player, he reached out to African Americans and welcomed them in the big leagues and was supportive of them later as a general manager for the Indians and the White Sox and trying to give them opportunities that they hadn't had.
Now, you write of an incident in the book early on in the 1947 season. This is after the war. He's a well-established star playing first base for the Pittsburgh Pirates, his last year playing, and this is Jackie Robinson's debut year. And there's a throw coming to first base. Robinson hits it. He's running out of a base hit. Throw comes to Greenberg. It's sort of off the bag, and he sort of moves into the baseline, and Robinson plows into him. And this could have been a very ugly situation, and he was just like, you're just one of us. You're another ball player. It was, and actually it was sort of unusual for him because he was usually pretty combative if somebody did that to him.
Yeah, Greenberg had been in fights before in such situations, but this was a significant moment in Jackie Robinson's debut. You mentioned it was 1947. Robinson's breaking the color barrier. It's early May. Robinson has just gone public with the abuse that he's been receiving, not just catchers spitting on his shoes and guys spiking him on the base paths, pitchers throwing at his head, but he was talking about, or he went public about the mail he received of threats against his wife, threats to kidnap his infant son, death threats he'd received. So he was feeling particularly vulnerable. Right after that, he played in Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia Philly players pointed bats at him as though they were rifles, pretending to shoot him. So he went from Philadelphia quite shaken by that and almost ready to quit, very discouraged. And he has this collision with Greenberg at first base. And I think the crowd was expecting some sort of race riot to break out. And had it been any white player other than Greenberg, it may very well have. But Greenberg went for the ball. Robinson scuttled off to second base. The next inning, Greenberg reached first. Jackie was playing first base. And Greenberg said, hey, I should have asked, are you okay? And Robinson said, yeah, I just lost my footing. And Greenberg said, listen, hang in there. You're doing fine. Keep your chin up. You'll be okay. And Robinson afterwards said, class tells. It sticks out all over Mr. Greenberg. And I think Hank giving him the support he did as a white opponent gave Robinson the support and courage he needed to continue on and leave the legacy that he did.
Greenberg was not the first Jew in the major leagues, but he was the first Jewish superstar, if you will. And he endured much of the same things that, maybe not to the same extent of Jackie Robinson, but he endured an awful lot. Pitchers would throw behind his head. Now, if you think about that, if you throw at the head, you can duck. But if you throw behind the head, the initial reaction is to back into the pitch. He endured a lot of things out on the ball field.
Bertie Tebbets, who was Greenberg's teammate for years, said, other than Jackie Robinson, no one endured more abuse than Greenberg. And it's true, pitchers throwing at him, guys trying to spike him, guys yelling nasty stuff at him. And as I mentioned, he stood up to that and sometimes used his fists, both with teammates and with opponents, to protect himself. Other times he used his bat, and really it was his legacy to hit home runs and long balls too, put opponents in their place. And there was one point in 1938 he was threatening Babe Ruth's single-season home run record. He ended with 58 at the end of the year. But he said during that season, with what was going on in Europe and what was he was experiencing at home, he felt like every home run he hit was a blow against Hitler.
My guest today is John Rosengren, a journalist and author. His new book is titled Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes. And it's published by the New American Library. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa as we talk about baseball today on the first day of baseball season and about Hank Greenberg. You mentioned earlier Detroit was sort of an interesting city for him to play in, but he was a native New Yorker. If he would have played in New York, I think he would have had a much different career. Detroit was the home of Henry Ford, and despite all the revisionist histories, you recount a lot of the horrific things Henry Ford said about Jews. during the 1920s and 30s. And then you also had it was also the home of Father Coughlin, who was saying the same sort of thing about Jews on his radio shows. And Detroit was a blue-collar town. Hank Greenberg came in making a lot of money, even in the minor leagues. He was always the highest-paid Detroit Tiger. It didn't necessarily sit well with the fans. You would think that the one place a person who's breaking this ethnic barrier he could count on would be his hometown fans, and that was not always the case.
No, Detroit was a hostile environment for Greenberg. As you mentioned, Henry Ford was there. He was considered the arch anti-Semite of America. He was writing these screeds against Jews in his paper, The Dearborn Independent, during the 20s, with headlines such as, "The Peril of Baseball, Too Much Jew." And then there was Charles Coughlin with his radio show of 10 million listeners. Coughlin had a parish in suburban Detroit, and the stuff he said sounded like it had been written by Hitler's goons. So Greenberg comes into this environment where Jews were a very small percentage, only about 5% of Detroit's makeup. And as I mentioned, he came from the Bronx, where he never really had to think about what it meant to be Jew, because everyone around him was Jew, and Jews were accepted. And here he's in Detroit, and the Jews are being maligned, again, not just by Ford and Coughlin, but by a lot of fans as well. And so he felt the extra pressure that when he struck out, he wasn't just a bum, but he was a Jewish bum. And so he'd endure the insults directed at his ethnicity as well. And that spurred him to want to do better, but it also, he started to understand that he was a representative of Jews. And as you mentioned before, there were many people on his team and even in other cities who had never met a Jew before. And so Greenberg, to them, was what a Jew was. And so whatever he did would be what people thought of Jews. And so obviously the more success he had, the higher he raised Jews in others' opinion. And that was a lot of the pressure he felt to not just perform as a ball player. You know, it's hard enough to hit a baseball trailing 90, 95 miles an hour, but to have to do it not just for yourself and for your team, but for your race, it becomes an enormous responsibility.
What was his impact in the Jewish community? You hear tons of Jewish kids who grew up and just said Hank Greenberg was absolutely their idol. And it had a cultural significance far beyond baseball.
Right. They embraced him as one of their own. A guy named Bert Gordon, who grew up in Detroit idolizing Greenberg, said it was almost like when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon and we had this feeling of like, hey, as an American, he's one of ours. Well, it was the same way they felt as Jews toward Greenberg. He's one of ours. And Walter Matthau tells the story of growing up in New York City and hearing about what Greenberg did. And he said, suddenly we've got this colossus and he's on our side. And he said it put an end to all those jokes that began, how many Jewish pants pressers does it take to?
Yeah.
And so, yes, there's this feeling of pride and of ownership, and he became a true hero to not just the youth, but the parents as well. And for many parents who were immigrants themselves, Greenberg and how Greenberg did became a way of identifying with America and understanding America. So he almost became the gateway for many immigrants in understanding American culture by their following him and learning about baseball and America's pastime.
He's probably one of the more astute businessmen as baseball players as well.
He was incredibly intelligent, and people say he could have been successful doing whatever he chose to do, and he proved that to be true later when he ran the Indians and then the White Sox, but also when he worked as a stockbroker and made a lot of money with his investments. So he early on, and this is the days before agents, before, you know, pre-Scott Boras, he was negotiating on his own behalf. And early on, it rubbed the Detroit Tigers owner, Frank Navin, wrong. He was a penny pincher and widely renowned for wanting to save money. And he was a cagey businessman himself. But Greenberg learned to use whatever leverage he could. And ultimately, as he became a major leaguer, he understood that the RBI, the runs batted in, was the best measure of a player's value to the team, and that was what he aimed for. It also, he thought, was not just a measure of one's worth, but of how he could best help his team win games by driving in runs, and so that was what he aspired to. And he became very good at it, hitting 170 in one season and driving in 183 runs in another season, which are just phenomenal totals today. But he used those as leverage and then to negotiate his contracts. And actually in 1936, he held out for extra money. And that's when people did sour on him somewhat in Detroit. As you mentioned, it's blue-collar city, and people thought, hey, he's already making a bunch as a ballplayer. Why does he have to ask for more? But he understood that you, as a ballplayer, you have a very limited time to earn your money. And then once your talent runs out, your earning power dries up. And there's a famous story about Walter Briggs, who took over from Navin as the Detroit Tigers owner, saying, young man, this is more money than I made when I was your age, and it's what I'm making now. And Greenberg said, yes, but when I'm your age, I won't be making this money anymore, and so I've got to make it now.
Of course, as a career, you have to remember he missed how many years due to military service in World War II? Four?
He was in the military for 47 months, and so he missed three full seasons and parts of two others, and he played nine full seasons.
Now, give us a sense of his baseball statistics, because this is how we judge ballplayers from, you know, Ty Cobb to Barry Bonds.
Right. So he led the league in home runs four times. He led the league in RBI four times. He was a two-time MVP. He had a .313 lifetime batting average. And because he only played nine full seasons, his overall totals are not as high as many of his the other guys in the Hall of Fame. But he hit 331 home runs, and when he retired, that was fifth best on the all-time list. But someone from the Society for American Baseball Research had projected if he had played all those games that he missed during the military, he likely would have hit at least 500 home runs. Bill James, who's the sabermetrician extraordinaire, thinks that Greenberg would have hit 600 home runs if he'd had the chance to hit against replacement pitchers. So his numbers, they were very good for what they were, but could have been even better had he had the chance to play all those years. But even as it was, he hit 58 home runs that one year, which in 1938 almost broke Babe Ruth's single-season record. He hit 183 RBIs one year, which was just one shy of Lou Gehrig's American League record. And he's, along with Babe Ruth, he and Babe are the only players to collect at least 96 extra base hits in four different seasons. And along with Lou Gehrig and Sam Thompson, he averaged the most RBIs per game, almost one per game, or .92 RBI per game. So his production, the quality of his statistics is very strong, even if the quantity doesn't measure up to the guys with more longevity.
And he led his team to how many World Series? Three, four?
They four? Went to the World Series four times, so they won the pennant four times, and they won the World Series twice.
Yeah.
Well, so in nine seasons, that's pretty darn good.
Yeah. And the other thing was he came back, and after being 4 years in the military, he still had a decent year, his first year back from the war.
That's one of the most extraordinary chapters of Greenberg's career, I believe, is after missing 47 months, more than any other major league ballplayer.
And he was a lot older. He was well over 30.
Right. He comes back. He's 34 years old. He's missed 47 months. He's hasn't played in the military. A lot of guys like Ted Williams, Joe DiMaggio, Bob Filler played baseball during their military careers. Greenberg didn't. He played three exhibition games in those 4 years. So he comes back, and he's the first star to come back. So it's not just the Tigers looking for him to do well, but in the summer of 45, America is looking to the national pastime to return it, the country to a sense of normalcy and to allow it to heal from the sacrifices of the war. So Greenberg becomes the test case. And in his first game back, he hits a home run. It's as though Odysseus has returned and Penelope rejoices. But then the season goes on, and in the final game of the 1945 season, Greenberg, in the ninth inning, hits a grand slam home run to clinch the pennant for the Tigers and then goes on to lead them to victory in the World Series. It becomes the most amazing comeback in all of sports, but it has this added significance of helping America return to normalcy after the war and heal itself and gives the country hope that it will be okay after this war.
What's amazing, though, is here this is a guy, he's been in Detroit his whole career. Within a year after this incredible moment, Detroit gives him his outright release.
It astounded many people in Detroit. Just broke their hearts that Walter Briggs, the owner, would let Greenberg go. And Briggs used this as an excuse, an article in the Sporting News, which was the Bible at the time of baseball news. In this article, the writer Dan Daniel had suggested that Greenberg wanted to finish his career in New York, where he'd grown up, and there was a photograph of Greenberg holding a Yankee jersey that seemed to support this contention. Now, the photograph was taken 3 years earlier when Greenberg had played in a war bond game in New York, but that wasn't explained in the newspaper. So some of the Detroit media jumped on Greenberg, calling him disloyal. Some of the fans got angry at him, and Briggs used this as an excuse to get rid of Greenberg. Mainly it was Briggs was upset over Greenberg's salary. He was the highest paid player in the game at the time. And Briggs and Greenberg had bickered about money, and I think Briggs viewed Greenberg as being ungrateful, so he waved him out of the league. Greenberg was the reigning home run champion at the time and had had this great season, as you mentioned, a year before in 45, and Briggs dumped him to Pittsburgh.
You don't come out and say it, but I wonder if it was anti-Semitism that was at the heart of it.
You know, I looked for that, and certainly one has to ask that question. Briggs was a Catholic, and the Catholics during that day, as we've discussed, were not known for their great tolerance and acceptance of Jews. But I couldn't find any hard evidence that Briggs was anti-Semitic or that factored into his decision.
After Greenberg's playing days, he was a general manager of the Cleveland Indians. But what was really interesting was some people touted him as a possible commissioner of baseball at one point. And you discussed some of his ideas that he had about baseball. They were really, really interesting. The league has come to embrace some of those ideas, but it took them how many years? 30, 40 years?
It took a while for others to catch on, though. As I mentioned, I mean, Greenberg was a very bright guy, and he envisioned things like baseball on the West Coast. 10 years before the Dodgers and Giants moved out there, he was looking to invest in a ball club up there. He wanted to own the Angels franchise, but got kind of pushed out by Walter O'Malley, and there I think some anti-Semitism may have come into play. But he also had advocated for interleague play. I mean, this was back in the 50s. He was advocating for this, and Bud Selig told me that it was Greenberg who had inspired him to eventually accept or implement the interleague play. And so I think Greenberg deserves some credit there. I think as far as the smarts and the knowledge of baseball, having been a player, an owner, and a general manager, Greenberg would have been a great commissioner. As far as his personal skills with others, he would have had a hard time because he had a bit of a thin skin. He was rather bullheaded, very competitive. And I think if the owners had wanted someone to just do things their way, he would not have been their man.
Well, it's a really interesting story. At a time in America's history when Jews around the country were under assault, Hank Greenberg became the symbol to the community and broke a lot of important barriers in our society. Hank Greenberg, the hero of heroes. John Rosengren, thanks very much for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me, Rich. My pleasure.
Baseball writer and journalist John Rosengren is the author of Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes, published by the New American Library. Today is opening day of the new baseball season. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.